Well, you know, sometimes people say that Christians have a blind faith. And for me, that's hard to take, because I have spent more time studying the basis for the Christian faith than anything else that I've ever studied in my life. And I can tell you, without any reservation, that faith in Jesus Christ is not a blind faith. It is based on solid evidence. It is based on eyewitness testimony. It is based on historical attestation. It's backed by archaeological evidence. The Christian faith is solid. It is solid in every single way. God enlightens us from both the inside, from our heart, just as Damon was saying, and he also enlightens us from the world around us. We have creation. We have the scriptures. Like we said before, I said a minute ago, we have archaeology. We have evidence coming from both sides, so that we know God is real, we know Christ is real, from both the inside and from the outside. The Apostle John explains the inward light in John 1:9, where he says that, and he's speaking of Jesus, was the true light which gives light to every man coming into the world. This is one of the key, and we have some other passages, but this is a key one that helps us to understand that every single one of us has this basic understanding that there is a God. We sometimes call it a God-sized hole. We have a conscience that understands right and wrong. We have something drawing us to a God, and we all know it. We all get that. And so there is this pull, again, from within side. And John calls it a light. He goes on in 12:32 and says, "And I, if I am lifted up from the earth," and this, by the way, is Christ speaking. They're quoting Christ. And he says, "If I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself." He's speaking of his crucifixion. And through his resurrection, he draws all men to himself, he says here. And then we go on into Romans 1:20, where Paul is talking, and he says, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature," we're talking about God, "have been clearly seen." Again, speaking of creation, you cannot look around at this creation and come up not believing in a God. It doesn't make any sense. To have something come from nothing, science has never been able to come up with an answer as to how we got here. It's because it's a God, and he doesn't choose to be found that way. He chooses to be found by common sense. Here we are. It took a God to get here. So creation alone, to me, is enough to convince me of a God. And if I go on and want to talk about Jesus Christ specifically, you know, there's one core piece of evidence that is enough to convince me that Jesus Christ is who he said he was, and that is the Son of God, and that he died and rose again. And there is, again, only one piece of evidence that, to me, is enough to cover that base, and that is the testimony of the apostles. If we consider the apostles, there's a number of things about them that make this testimony very unique. First of all, we have 12 of them. 13 if you count Paul, minus one, you take away Judas, and we're still back to 12. Okay, so we have 12 apostles. And they all go on unanimously to preach the gospel of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So we have 12. Unanimous voices speaking in unison about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, they were eyewitnesses. They were there after Christ arose. They all attest that they saw the risen Christ. So they know that he died, and they know that he arose. So their testimony is unique in that they were eyewitnesses. Also, they spent 3 years with Jesus, so they knew who they were talking about. They knew this man well. And they, although they went through their periods of doubt when they were with Jesus, in fact, they went through lots of doubts. They sometimes questioned. When they were, for example, on the boat with Jesus, they were afraid, and Jesus sometimes had to reprimand them and say, "Oh, you, ye of little faith, believe, trust me." So they went through their faith journey with Christ. But they knew him, and they learned about him, and they came to believe that indeed he must be the Son of God. But these, again, were ordinary men. Most of them were fishermen. They were doubters. Recall the time also when they were asleep, when Christ is in the garden praying, and they fall asleep. So we just got ordinary guys. These are not great men of faith while they're following Jesus. They're just ordinary guys, fishermen, learning about Christ, living with him, coming to believe in him stronger and stronger. But even through that, Peter denied Christ 3 times. So we have to ask ourselves, what happened that made this change? That these men went from ordinary men who were sometimes doubters, just fishermen, to being willing to die for Christ. Another thing that's interesting about them is that not one of them ever recanted their faith or their belief or actually their story. Now we say faith, belief, but I actually mean their story, their explanation of what happened, that Jesus Christ died and rose again. This is what they claimed. And they claimed this for 30 to 40 years after Christ died. They continued with the same message. Jesus Christ died and rose. So we have 12 people proclaiming for 30 to 40 years after the event the same unanimous story in various cities around the world, especially throughout the Roman Empire primarily. And so they weren't together in various cities over a great period of time, 12 of them, and they proclaimed the same exact story, even though they were being martyred for what they were proclaiming. This is very, very strong evidence for me, and I believe it should be for you, that you could have this many people proclaiming that message. So the question is, what transformed them, again, from these ordinary guys into extraordinary people willing to die for their story that Jesus Christ rose from the dead? And, one of the questions that we have to answer as well is, do you recall when Christ was being crucified, where all the apostles were? They were hiding, just to reflect back. They were hiding when Christ was being crucified. They weren't all on the scene. They knew he got crucified, but they weren't all on the scene. They were hiding. And in fact, when Christ appeared to them, he appeared to them because they were where they were hiding. So he goes to them, okay? So I just want to reemphasize that these are ordinary men. They're hiding. They're scared. They're afraid. They just saw a crucifixion. They didn't want to be next, okay? Then they saw the risen Lord. That is the turning point. They saw the risen Lord. They went at that point from men in hiding, men afraid to show their face, afraid that they were going to be the next to be executed, to 12 men unanimously going out through the world preaching the gospel in the face of persecution, no matter what happened. I believe that that transformation can only point to the resurrection had actually happened, and those men went from somewhat fearful, doubting men to absolute convinced this is the Son of God. Nobody else can rise from the dead. that he appeared to me, and I now am going to go to the world, and I don't care if I get executed, I am proclaiming the gospel of Jesus Christ. There's no other explanation. There is no other explanation, Clyde. 12 of them throughout the world, different cities, over 20, 30 years. You know, over those years, they heard little stories come back. Did you know John got executed? Whoa, bummer. What are you going to do about it? I'm going to preach. That happened time and time again. Another death. They heard about it. It didn't all happen at once. In another city, they heard about it. Are you going to keep preaching? Yes, I'm going to preach. Why? Because it's true. And because my hope is eternal. Because I saw the resurrected Lord. Can you imagine how that would affect us if we saw? That is our proof. These disciples, these apostles that died, is our proof of the resurrection. Their death is a testimony in blood that tells us that this is a true story. This really happened. The letters and the documents put together to form the New Testament are our best source to understand what happened with these disciples. But for those who sometimes are not sure, well, wait a minute, those are Christians and they all put down what they wanted to, I want to show you that there's also corroborating evidence in history. We have, for example, Joseph ben Matthias, most often called Josephus. And he lived at the same time as the apostles. He's a little bit younger than them, but he was alive throughout all of their lives. And he is a Jewish Pharisee who never converted to Christianity. So he has no reason whatsoever to want to believe the story. And in fact, he does not believe the story of the resurrection as told by the apostles. However, he does write a history of the Jews, and included, he has this passage about Jesus Christ. Here's what Josephus writes in the Antiquities of the Jews, chapter 18, 63. At this time there was a wise man who was called Jesus, and his conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous. And many people from among the Jews and the other nations became his disciples. Pilate condemned him to be crucified and to die. And those who had become his disciples did not abandon their loyalty to him. They sure didn't. They reported that he had appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion, and that he was alive. Accordingly, they believed that he was the Messiah, concerning whom the prophets have recounted wonders. Let me remind you that this is not coming from a Christian source. This is a non-Christian source explaining the history, contemporary with the apostles, telling you the history of Jesus Christ and his apostles. The evidence outside the Bible by non-Christian Jews as well as the Romans explain this story very clearly. And that is that the Jews denied Christ as their Messiah and persecuted the Christians. But you know, that was nothing compared to what the Romans would do. Starting with the great fire of Rome, the Romans went much further in persecuting the Christians than what the Jews did. You see, what happened with the great fire of Rome was that the populace, there was this fire in Rome, huge fire. It destroyed 3 of the 14 districts completely, and 7 of them it seriously damaged, leaving only 4 without the fire. So Rome went through this devastating fire. And the populace believed that Nero, the emperor himself, was behind it. They thought that he was wanting to destroy the slums and part of the city in order for him to set up this big villa for himself. And in fact, after the fire, that's exactly what he did. Nobody knows to this day whether or not Nero was responsible for the fire. But what Nero was catching a lot of flack from the people because they all thought he started his own city on fire, killing so many people for his own benefit. And he, even though he's emperor, did not want that kind of political negativity. So what did he do? He blamed on the Christians. We'll blame it on the Christians. And in fact, they tortured Christians until they confessed. And I suppose under enough torture, any of us will say just about anything. So some of the Christians agreed that we started the fire. So from that fire, the greatest persecution of the Christians began in AD 64, only 30 years after Christ, while all the apostles but two were still alive. And we see this written by Tacitus, who was a Roman historian. And as a Roman historian who lived again contemporary with most of the apostles, he knew the history and also had access to all the libraries in Rome. And he went on to explain what happened during this fire in Rome. He writes in his book called The Annals, "Consequently, to get rid of the report, of course, being the fire was started by himself. Consequently, to get rid of that report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations." Now, Tacitus is not a Christian, okay? So he's calling the Christians, what they're doing, an abomination. Now, what was their abomination, according to Tacitus? Most likely that they would not bow down to the emperor. Because as Christians, they didn't feel that that God would have them to bow down to the emperor. So they call the Christians an abomination. Okay? So Tacitus writes this, that they were tortured on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, which is the Latin term, from the whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty, which in that day was crucifixion. During the reign of Tiberius, at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. And a most mischievous superstition. And what do you think that superstition might have been? The resurrection. And a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Accordingly, an arrest was first made of all who pleaded guilty. Then upon their information, an intense multitude was convicted, not so much of the crime of firing the city, but as of hatred against mankind. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burnt, to serve as a nightly illumination when daylight had expired. It was said that Nero said that burning the Christians fit the crime, since they burned the city, and we're going to burn the Christians. Peter and Paul both died under Nero during this persecution between 64 and 68 AD. So do you think that persecution stopped the apostles? It would have stopped me. Would it have stopped you? I'd have slowed down maybe just a little bit preaching. But they had seen the risen Lord. And they weren't about, even though they were ordinary fishermen who had their doubts before Christ's resurrection, after they saw him resurrected, they were different men and they were preaching the gospel in the face of all of this kind of persecution. Paul ended up being beheaded. Luckily, he was a Roman citizen, so they couldn't crucify him. Peter, on the other hand, wasn't so lucky. He was crucified upside down. What commitment to serve the Lord. It's unbelievable. Christians were persecuted by the Jews and the Romans for 250 more years. But the power of the gospel, as evidenced by the resurrection, continued to spread throughout the Roman Empire anyway. The rise of Christianity in the face of heavy persecution from both the Jews and the Romans cannot be explained unless there was a resurrection. Christianity rose in a place that was not budding a belief like this. It was they wanted it down, and yet it forced through because of the power of the resurrection. So let's look at how the apostles died, because their death is our proof. Their death is a testimony in blood for us. Next slide, please. For us to understand the truth that they told us. So here's how they died. Next slide, please. We start off with James, the brother of John, son of Zebedee, who's a fisherman. James was beheaded. In Acts 12, 1-2, it says, "About that time, King Herod laid hands on some from the church to harm them. He had James, the brother of John, executed with a sword in Judea in AD 44. Andrew, brother of Simon Peter, a fisherman, Andrew was crucified in a spread eagle position on an X-shaped cross in Patras in AD 70. We have Philip, an apostle, tortured and crucified by hostile Jews in Hierapolis in AD 54. And James the Just, son of Alphaeus. James was cast down from the pinnacle of the temple, refusing to denounce the resurrection, then bludgeoned to death with a fuller's club in Jerusalem in AD 63. Matthew, also known as Levi, a tax collector, was slain with a sword in Navadar in AD 60. Matthias, who replaced Judas after his death, Matthias was hung on a cross and then stoned in Ethiopia in AD 70. Jude, also known as Thaddeus, was beaten to death with sticks in Mesopotamia in AD 72. And John, brother of James, the son of Zebedee, a fisherman, was cast into a cauldron of boiling oil, but he lived, and many years later died of natural causes in Ephesus in AD 95, the only of the 12 disciples not to be martyred. And Bartholomew, also known as Nathanael, Bartholomew was skinned alive and then crucified in Durban in AD 70. Simon the Zealot was crucified by the governor in Syria in AD 74. And Paul, as we said, was beheaded with a sword under the persecution of Nero in Rome in AD 67. Thomas, also called Didymus, because he was a twin and known as the doubting Thomas, wasn't such a doubter after the resurrection, because he continued to proclaim the gospel until he was thrust through with pine spears, tormented with red-hot plates, then burned alive in Mylapore in AD 70. And Simon Barjona, we know him as Peter the Rock, who was a fisherman, was crucified head down at his own request because he felt unworthy to die in the same way that Jesus Christ had died in Rome in AD 64. So there's a few people that sometimes have objections. They say things like, well, maybe the 12 were lying. Could you give me one motive for being one of the 12 lying when they never showed any power, wealth, any kind of fame that you would want? Anything. There's nothing that they had to gain. Furthermore, when you're being executed over a 30-year period in multiple cities around the Roman Empire. How are you going to hold to such an agreement where all 12 of you are agreeing not to say anything? We watch the crime shows where you put two people in two rooms and they talk to them separately and one of them gives, right? We got 12 of these guys in different places at different times. All are going to hold to that? That's nonsense. There's no motive, and it doesn't even make sense that people would hold to such all the way to execution without any reason. They would start to give. Anybody can see that. Another thought is, well, maybe they're delusional. They didn't act delusional. The Gospels don't show delusional people. They preached a message and they were not called delusional at the time. They were called maybe liars and things of that. They were not called delusional. They didn't act delusional. It doesn't fit. And 12 of them? All delusional? If you said, well, you just saw something you didn't really see? People who are delusional don't see things that are the same. That would have to require collusion. So delusion doesn't make sense. And last, sometimes people think, well, you know, a lot of people die for their faith. We have the 9/11 bombers, for example, and they died for their faith, right? They did. And you know, I'll give them credit. The 9/11 bombers and the suicide bombers do die for their faith. And what does that tell me? That gives credibility that they believe. The difference here is, I'm not asking whether or not the apostles believed. I'm asking whether or not they're telling the truth. See, the 9/11 bombers don't know the truth. They believe a story told to them through their religion and was willing to die for their belief, but we don't know if they were right or wrong. In fact, we know they're wrong. You guys died for a lie. You don't even know what you're talking about. The 12 apostles aren't in that boat. See, because they were there. They saw it. So we're not asking them what you believe. We're asking why you were willing to die. And they said, I'm willing to die because I saw personally, me, my own eyes, I saw the risen Christ. That's why I'm willing to die. Those two examples are worlds apart. To die for what you believe, completely different than willing to die for what you know is true. So to me, that's strong enough evidence. Faith in Jesus Christ is not a blind faith. The evidence is solid. There is no reasonable alternative. We know there's a God in our heart. We know there's a God because of creation. We know the apostles had to be telling the truth. Their death is our proof, and Jesus Christ rose from the dead. Enough said. So next week, we're beginning a new class. And I would like to invite any of you that would like to continue a discussion about faith, whether it's the evidence outside or whether it's what's going on in your own heart and trying to understand how faith works. We will also be going into the issues of hope and love. It'll be a 15-week class during both services, and if you'd like to join, sign up out back. And now I'd like to have Clyde come up and talk about what is it that we're going to do with the evidence that is absolutely true about the resurrection.
My motor's running.
When it gets to the heart.
There you go. The heart. Good stuff, huh? Got a minute? I have a question for you today. And here's the question. What is man's deepest and greatest need? What do you think it is? It's forgiveness. It's man's greatest need is forgiveness. I know that's true. Because I know that was true for me in my life. You know, we have all done stuff in our life. We look back at our life and there's things we've done and man feels ashamed about those things. In fact, he feels guilty about those things. So man's greatest need is to know that he is forgiven, that his heart has been cleansed. And if you're honest with yourself, you know, you probably have some skeletons in your closet there. I look back at my life I look and I think, man, you were a wreck, Clyde. You were a wreck. Man's greatest need is to know that when he dies, where he's going. Man's greatest need is to know that he's forgiven. The Bible says in Romans 3:23 that we have all sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We know we're messed up. In the verse Bobby talked about earlier about John 1:9, God has enlightened every man's heart that's come into the world. We know that we have a need. God has put it inside of us. Man, when you think about it, the message, the power of the resurrection, what he's talking about. Wow. So the question today is, this need you have you come to the point in time in your life when you realize, that's it. I want Jesus Christ in my life. I want to be cleansed of my sin. And you may be sitting here today and you listen to the evidence there. It was pretty clear. It was pretty simple. It wasn't simple for them, though, was it? They paid a pretty big price for believing. But man, I wonder what it was like when they died and they stepped on the other side. So the question today is, if you died right now, where are you going? Heaven? Are you? Do you want to go to heaven? Do you want to live forever? It's simple. See, what he was talking about was Romans 5:8. But God commended his love toward us, and while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. What that says to you and to me is that he's not waiting for you to somehow clean yourself all up and present your God and say, am I good enough? No, that means that he takes you right where you're at. Let's go a little deeper with it. You could have walked in here with a syringe hanging out of your arm. You could have walked in here smelling like a marijuana factory. You could have walked in here with every hair in your nose burned out from snorting cocaine and came to Christ today and got saved and know that you're forgiven of all your sin and you're on your way to heaven. I'm going to tell you what, if that doesn't charge you up, I don't know what else I can say. So is he in your life? Do you want him in your life? Do you want to know if you died where you'd go? Do you want this forgiveness? If that's true about you, let's just bow our heads. For this moment in time, you may be saying to yourself, you know, Clyde, I want that salvation you're talking about. I want to know if I died where I'd go. A simple prayer, my friend. It's called a sinner's prayer. And if you pray that prayer, believing in your heart that Jesus was raised from the dead and that he is your Lord, in Romans 10:13, he says, everyone that will call upon him will be saved. And you can be saved right now. As our heads are bowed, I'm going to pray the prayer, and you just repeat after me, realizing that I'm doing no more than leading you, and you yourself are speaking to God. Just pray with me right now. Dear Lord Jesus, I know that I am a sinner. I ask you to forgive me of all my sins and to come into my heart and life and be the Lord of my life and save me today. As our heads are bowed and you're sitting in the choir, see, I'd just like to know, if you prayed that prayer today, would you just let me know? I'm not going to ask you to do anything. Just raise your hand. Just raise your hand, let me know, and put it right back down. You prayed that prayer. Thank you. Anybody else? Thank you. I've seen that. Anybody else? Thank you. Anybody else? Okay, look up here. Could I get everybody just to stand for a moment as we get ready to dismiss? It's amazing.